Thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here. I'm sorry to arrive a little bit late. So I'm going to present some stuff from the lab, some stuff that we did in the past few years. Some of it is published, some not. And please interrupt me at whatever moment if I'm not clear with what I'm saying or so. So my lab has been working for the past several years on this so-called balance between excitation and inhibition. The balance between excitation and inhibition has attracted many labs in the past few years, and mainly because this this relationship between those two opposing conductances, right, has been implied in many important things, including sensory processing and motor coordination and higher cognitive function. And it's well known since the 40s, actually, since the 50s, that slight imbalances in this relationship between excitation and inhibition can lead to pathological states. Like epilepsy, coma, or schizophrenia. So I see that I don't have the entire screen. I hope it's not going to be too bad for the data there. There is probably 10 inches missing on this side. And sorry?
Just the noisy one.
Yes, just the noise, hopefully. So the relationship between excitation and inhibition is highly dynamic in the brain, and through this constant changing ratio, distinct neurons are active at distinct times, either in response to sensory stimuli or during intrinsic activity. Another thing that I would like to highlight, which should be very clear, is that at least in the cortex, excitation and inhibition are essentially inseparable events, right? They walk hand in hand. And now there are many experiments that show that one very simple one that one can do is record from a superficial pyramidal cell in the somatosensory cortex, for example, layer 2-3, right? And then give a very simple stimulus like moving a whisker on the opposite side of the face of the rat, and if you voltage clamp the cell at the reversal potential of inhibition in order to isolate excitatory postsynaptic current in this pyramidal neuron, you will see that in response to the whisker stimulus, you get an excitatory response. However, if you voltage clamp now the same neuron at 0 millivolt or a plus 10 millivolt in this case, just to be more or less at the reversal potential for excitation, isolate inhibitory conductances, you see that exactly the same exact same stimulus, right, produce an inhibitory response. So even in response to the most simple stimuli, excitation and inhibition work hand in hand, and the fact that they are essentially inseparable is not can also be seen during spontaneous ongoing activity in the hippocampus. If you record from the CA3 region of the hippocampus of an anesthetized rodent, a rat in this case, this hippocampus oscillates at gamma frequency ongoingly. This is a well-known characteristic of the hippocampus in an anesthetized animal, and you can look at this gamma activity, and you can again voltage clamp a pyramidal cell, a CA3 pyramidal cell, at the reversal potential for inhibition to isolate excitation, and you see those events that oscillate at 40 hertz. But then you can then voltage clamp the same neuron at the reversal potential for excitation, and you will see that you have an oscillatory activity that can be observed also as inhibitory events. So essentially, excitation and inhibition appear to be inseparable, both in response to sensory stimulation as well as during ongoing spontaneous activity in cortical structure. Now, the question that I've been addressing over the past several years in the lab is what coordinates excitation with inhibition. While most of my work in the past was about the coordination in time of excitation and inhibition, today I'm going to talk some more about the coordination in space. So to begin with, as I'm sure now everybody knows here, neurons in the cortex can be subdivided in two main groups, excitatory and inhibitory neuron. In the brain in general, the vast majority of excitatory neurons are glutamatergic, and the vast majority of inhibitory neurons are GABAergic. And in the cortex in particular, GABAergic neuron represents 20 to 30% of the entire inhibitory neuronal population, and a very heterogeneous group of neurons. And the rest, the 80%, 70 to 80% are excitatory glutamatergic neuron. So coordinating excitation and inhibition in cortical space, I would like to divide the talk in two parts. One is speaking about cortical space within a single neuron, namely how the distribution of excitatory and inhibitory inputs along the somatodendritic axis of a pyramidal cell, right, affects the output of the pyramidal cell. And in the second part, I would like to speak more about networks, namely how the distribution of excitation and inhibition in space within a network of neurons affect the output of that network. But let's start with the single neuron. And so this is a hippocampal CA1 pyramidal neuron is the main soldier of the hippocampus. It's the pyramidal cell that gives rise to an axon that is going to leave the hippocampus. And this pyramidal neuron receives about 30,000 excitatory inputs onto its apical and basal dendrite. And it's absolutely devoid of excitatory input in the somatic compartment. And in fact, the somatic compartment is essentially reserved for the inhibitory input originating essentially from so-called basket cells. And this is an example of a hippocampal basket cell. In green, you have the dendrite of the basket cell, and in blue, the axon. Now, you see that you have to imagine that in the hippocampus, you have one single pyramidal cell layer. And so you have to imagine a number of pyramidal cells like this red one, all aligned such that their soma, their cell body, generates a layer. And this layer, within this layer, the axon of a basket cell arborizes to specifically target the soma of pyramidal cell. And basket cell, in fact, produce a very strong inhibitory conductance on pyramidal cell and can control their firing quite efficiently. And this was in fact, the basket cell is if you want one of the most studied GABAergic interneuron, because it was the first neuron that was actually identified as inhibitory in the cortex. The basket cell per se was first described by Eccles over 100 years ago, but it was identified as inhibitory identified as a basket cell. The basket cell was identified as a neuron by Ramón y Cajal over 100 years ago, but it was identified as an inhibitory neuron by Eccles about 50 years ago, right? So it's the first inhibitory neuron discovered in the cortex and has been studied very much. However, this doesn't mean that inhibition is exclusively somatic, right? In the hippocampus, as well as in other parts of the cortex, there are other types of neurons that inhibit the various compartments of pyramidal cell. This is a typical axoaxonic cell. In fact, it selectively targets the axon initial segment of pyramidal neuron. This is a so-called bistratified cell. You see that with its axonal arborization, it targets the proximal portion of the basal dendrite and of the apical dendrite, right? And it actually avoids the soma of pyramidal cell. And then you have the so-called OLM neuron that takes care of that particular compartment that was not affected by the other neuron. It specifically inhibits the distal portion of the apical dendrite of pyramidal cell, the apical tuft. And in fact, this cell is a cell that has its spondyl in the cortex, which is called Martinotti. Yes. So this is not Martinotti. This is, those are hippocampal interneurons, so they have a completely different nomenclature, despite the fact that they have their pendant in the cortex. This one is in the hippocampus, called OLM. And the reason why it's called OLM is because it has its body in the stratum oriens, right, O, and project its axon in the stratum lacunosum molecolare, LM, right? However, in terms of electrophysiological and immunohistochemical and morphological property, it matches very well the Martinotti cell in the cortex. And the reason is that it's somatostatin positive, so it expresses the protein somatostatin. It receives facilitatory excitatory inputs. It actually targets the dendrite and so on. This is a so-called axoaxonic or chandelier cell, and the amazing thing of this cell is that it has only one target, which is pyramidal cell at the axon initial segment.
So all of those ramifications.
Yes. Yes, yes. And in fact, one other peculiarity of this GABAergic interneuron is that it doesn't inhibit any other GABAergic interneuron. While there is some promiscuity between GABAergic interneurons, they tend to inhibit each other with very specific rules, actually. This guy doesn't.
Are they sparse, or do they have any overlapping?
They are hugely overlapping, actually. So, yeah, they are not tiled, at least not in the hippocampus. Sorry? Look, there is very few recordings from them, actually. We've got a few. Peter Somaggi has some. So, unfortunately, there is not yet a good marker for them that would create a mouse line that allows you to study them. Although I heard that Josh Wong might have some. But there are very few recordings, and clearly no paired recordings that would allow to tell if they're coupled or not. Well, you know, those are complete reconstruction with respect to a slice, right? So those were fillings that were not made in vivo. Those were fillings that were made in a slice, which means that part of the dendritic and axonal arborization might have already been damaged by the slicing procedure. But otherwise, they're complete. Sorry? On a pyramidal cell, yes. So there is a very nice study by Tamás Freund, who has reconstructed a series of CA1 pyramidal neuron, and essentially counted the spines on those pyramidal neuron in CA1. And if you assume that there is one connection per spine, and that most excitatory connection occur on spines and not on the dendritic shaft, then this is how one got the number. Yeah. So again, if you look at that particular paper by Tamás Freund, there is something like 2,700 or 3,000 inhibitory input onto those neurons. The highest concentration is
about
10%. Yeah. They are also very heterogeneously distributed, right? Those inhibitory input, there is a high concentration here within the first on the soma and within the first 50 to 100 microns from the soma, and then a very high concentration of inhibitory input out here.
Anatomically, different inhibitory, I mean, obviously,
right. So if you do, those are counted. The inhibitory synapses are counted as a density along the dendrite by using electron microscopy, right? And then
they're not.
Most of them are not on spine. I know that there are exceptions actually, but the vast majority are on the shaft, and you can recognize them at electron microscopic level because they are symmetric, right? They have no postsynaptic density. So those ones in the hippocampus are called bistratified. And the reason why they're called bistratified is exactly because you have two layers of their, they actually avoid the soma, right? And they expand their axonal arborization on two layers, one in the oriens and one in the radiatum. Okay? All right, so So this is this was just to there are actually much more, many more than four types of inhibitory neuron. Peter Somogyi has now something like 20 types or so in the hippocampus based on electrophysiological properties, anatomorphological property, immunohistochemical properties. But the reason why I'm showing those four ones here is just to convey the idea that the inhibition is compartmentalized, and it compartmentalized onto pyramidal cells, both in the hippocampus as well as in the cortex. And so the question is, what is the role of this compartmentalization of inhibition on the output of a pyramidal cell, right? And so in order to address this question, essentially to attribute a function to those various GABAergic interneurons, we started with a series of very simple experiments in which we would record from the dendrite of a hippocampal pyramidal cell, and we would mimic an excitatory synapse in the dynamic clamp mode. Essentially, instead of injecting a current into the pyramidal cell, you impose a conductance, and imposing a conductance means that you inject a current which is proportional to the membrane potential of the pyramidal cell minus the driving minus the reversal potential of the conductance you are mimicking. In this case, an excitatory conductance, hence the reversal potential is 0 millivolt, right? And in fact, so we mimic an excitatory conductance between 200 and 300 micrometers away from the soma of the pyramidal cell. And in fact, we do things very simple. Rather than giving the time course of a real excitatory conductance, like with a fast rise time and exponential decay, we just put a square excitatory conductance, all right? And what we can do is increase this conductance, this excitatory conductance, and measure the spiking of the pyramidal neuron in response to this artificial excitatory input placed somewhere along the apical dendrite, okay? And then we add inhibition. And to add inhibition, and obviously by doing this we can get an input-output relationship, right, in which this, on the x-axis we have the imposed excitatory conductance and the firing rate on the y-axis. And then we can mimic dendritic or somatic inhibition by applying with a puffer pipette a GABA A receptor agonist, right? In this case, Mucimol. Mucimol is an artificial compound that binds to GABA A receptor and opens them, right? And so we can puff a little bit of GABA here to mimic dendritic inhibition right at the side where we have our excitatory input. And we can ask, how does this affect the input-output relationship of this pyramidal cell, right? Or we can bring the pipette down at the soma, right, to mimic somatic inhibition like a basket cell, and again ask, how does this affect the input-output relationship of the pyramidal cell? And so this is now a real experiment in which we are imposing this excitatory conductance about 250 micrometer away from the soma with this patch pipette. And this is the response of the pyramidal cell here, excitation and firing rate. You see that it's saturated at around 30 hertz. Yes.
So 250.
What's that number on a scale of sort of electron tonic wire on a time scale of the craft?
How did you pick that number?
Well, no, you don't pick that number when you do dendritic recordings. You measure that number. You patch wherever you can, and then you measure what the distance is, right? Well, we did several. We do so. Look, so how do you choose a number which is above 100 micrometer? So you choose above 100 micrometers because within the first 100 micrometer from the soma, there is very little. The density of excitatory synapses is quite low, right? So if you want to be even just semi-realistic with the positioning of your excitatory input, you want to be above 100 micrometer. Then what happens is that after 300 micrometer, the dendrites of the pyramidal cell become incredibly thin, right? So you can no longer patch them, and so you are confined within that. Now the length constant of the apical dendrite, right? If you want to measure, it's about 200 micrometer or so. So that's at steady state. So that's
okay.
two. Alright, so this is the input-output relationship that you get by increasing the excitation here given in nanosiemens in the pyramidal cell. And now we can puff mucimol on the dendrite, right? And what you see that essentially what you do, you shift this input-output relationship to the right, okay? Which means what? Which means that you can obtain the same firing rate, you can squeeze out the same firing rate out of your pyramidal cell, right? But you just need a stronger excitation, as shown here. And so now the question is, what happens if we inhibit the soma rather than the dendrite of the pyramidal cell? And this is exactly the same pyramidal neuron, right? We redid an input-output curve just after this experiment, just after the application of dendritic mucimol. That's why the data don't look identical, but it's the exact same pyramidal cell. And then we inhibit the soma. And what you see is that not only there is a shift to the right of this curve, but there is also essentially a capping of the maximal frequency of the pyramidal cell, right? And this is somehow dose dependent. How do we change the dose of mucimol? Well, we clearly don't know the concentration of mucimol that is going to be applied through this buffer pipette that is going to be present at the GABA A receptor because it diffuses away. But what we can do is that we can change the frequency at which we puff this mucimol. Instead of doing ch-ch-ch, we can do ch-ch-ch-ch, right? And thereby increasing the concentration. And you see that when you inhibit the dendrite and you increase the concentration of mucimol, you keep on shifting this input-output curve to the right? But eventually, if you put enough excitation into the dendrite, you still reach the maximal firing rate. Well, if you do this at the soma, you squeeze down the response of your pyramidal cell, and actually, eventually, you can completely shut it down.
So, is the notion that in vivo with GABA B is something between the buckets?
No. Why? Right now I'm neglecting. You know, when I do an experiment, I want to neglect everything but the one thing that I'm testing. All right. So that's the way I try to put an experiment. I neglect the entire universe but for one thing. Here, the only thing that I'm caring is activation of GABA A receptor. And so I neglect everything else. Right. Now, the question is not that I'm neglecting. The question that you want to ask is, how come you're not, what would happen if you activate also GABA B receptor? And then my answer would be, well, I haven't done the experiment. I might do it in the future, which I probably won't. But yes, that's right. Exactly. Right. We could have puffed GABA, right? And GABA would have activated both GABA A and GABA B receptor. But here the goal was really to look at the effect of GABA A receptor. And the reason is that while we know for sure that each one of those GABAergic interneurons I've shown you before activate GABA A receptors, it is not clear whether all of them also activate GABA B receptor. In fact, there is some evidence that the somatic ones might not activate GABA B receptor, at least as well as the dendritic one, right? So if they have one thing in common is that they all activate GABA A receptor, and those GABA A receptors are distributed along the somatodendritic axis. All right. So essentially what we see here, right, is that when we inhibit the dendrite with mucimol, we shift the input-output curve to the right. And when we inhibit the soma with mucimol, we not only shift the input-output curve to the right, but we cap the maximal firing rate. And this is a summary graph of a number of similar experiments in which we plot on the x-axis the half maximal conduxant, the conduxant necessary to get half maximal firing rate, right? In the black curve, it would be something like maybe 3 nanosiemens, and on the green curve, maybe something like 11 nanosiemens, plotted against the maximal firing rate. And each one of those lines is a different experiment, connecting in black the control condition and in red the condition in which we squeeze mucimol on the dendrite. And what you can see is that while mucimol on the dendrite increases the conductance necessary to get half maximal firing rate, it doesn't affect the maximal firing rate, right? While the condition, the situation is very different for experiment in which we puff on the soma, right? You can see that we not only shift the half maximal, the conductor necessary to get half maximal firing rate, but we also actually reduce the maximal firing rate, okay? So essentially, dendritic inhibition shifts the input output to the right, and this shift of the curve is essentially a competitive action, right? So you have excitation and inhibition, they are matched in space, right? And they compete against each other. You increase inhibition, well, if you pay enough, essentially, if you put enough excitation, you are going to restore the situation in terms of firing rate, right? And so this gives you this shift to the right. On the other hand, there is this non-competitive action of inhibition on the soma with respect to the dendritic excitation, and the reason is that action potential are generated around here, right? And so you can reduce the maximal firing rate, Alex. Yes, those are steady states. Yeah, that's very good. In fact, sorry, this is indicated here by this. We measure the firing rate here at the end of the pulse where they more or less stabilize. Well, yes, that's it changes. We try to make sense of what's happening. Here there is a lot of stuff going on here. There are some calcium spikes, some dendritic generated stuff. And we work on it quite a bit to try to understand what was going on here, and it doesn't completely make sense yet. So yeah, it's we measured it here. Yeah. So there are differences in the time constant of inhibitory postsynaptic current generated in the dendrite in the soma. I'm not sure how much of it is actually due to the different composition of GABA A receptor versus the fact that very few inhibitory current have been recorded in the dendrite, right? So there can be some filtering. Nevertheless, independently of that, those time constants are very short with respect to the duration of our puff of GABA, right? So of puff or GABA, you have to imagine it's an increase in GABA concentration that lasts much, much longer than your synaptic increase in GABA concentration. And puff of muscimol is something that lasts seconds. And so it swamps out any time constant of receptors unless it's a desensitization time constant. Yeah, there is some desensitization to muscimol, yes. Yeah, there is not enough to cancel the effects, though, right? But there is. No, the only sort of dose response curve that I show is here, and it's not a dose response because there is no dose. What I show in those two curves is a muscimol applied at a lower concentration as compared to here, but I don't know what the concentration is.
Yeah, well, I was thinking just in terms of how close it is to saturating the
yeah. Okay, so yeah, actually, maybe I have that. No. So how close it is in reality, I can tell you with respect to the conductance that it generates, okay? So the conductances that we're generating here, and we clearly have a good estimate of the somatic conductance, we might just infer about the dendritic conductances, are perfectly in line with the amplitude of conductances opened by individual GABAergic interneurons. So for example, in order to get an effect like this, an increase in GABAergic conductance of 2 or 3 nanosiemens is more than sufficient. And 2 or 3 nanosiemens is essentially 2 or 3 basket cells. In the hippocampus, a basket cell is a nanosiemens of GABA. At the peak, is a nanosiemens of GABA A receptor mediated conductance on a pyramidal cell. And so 2-3 nanosiemens, right, is about 2-3 basket cells firing together. That would be at peak, yes. And this is steady state, yeah. Yeah, yes, yes, I agree with that. I agree with that, yes. No, I don't think so. So we've modeled this behavior, and I think that the easiest explanation for this difference in behavior is actually quite intuitive now, if you want to bear with me for a second. So imagine, let's think about just a hyperpolarizing effect, but it works as it works. The principle essentially the same if you think about shunting. So if imagine that you are hyperpolarizing here a portion of the apical dendrite with your puff of GABA, right? And you're hyperpolarizing by, say, 5 millivolts, right? So if you inject right there enough excitatory conductance, you're going to overcome this hyperpolarization and eventually depolarize your soma and the axon itself remnant sufficiently to bring back the original firing rate, which is this rightward shift. Now imagine that you are here. Here what you have, you can depolarize, in the extreme case scenario, you might depolarize your dendrite maximally, and maximally means reaching the reversal potential of the conductance that you're actually mimicking. In this case, an excitatory conductance, right? And the maximal depolarization that you can reach locally, right, is 0 millivolt, right? More than that, you can't do, right? You can inject as much conductance as you want, it's never going to go over zero. But yet, despite the fact that this piece of dendrite might be a 0 millivolt, you can still hyperpolarize the soma with your somatic inhibition and modulates the maximal firing rate of your pyramidal cell. So in this sense, it's non-competitive, right? Because you have this maximal depolarization of the dendrite with the excitation, and your inhibition is still able to modulate the firing rate by changing the membrane potential of your soma. And so this is the principle of non-competitiveness, and this is why you reach you can cap the maximal firing rate. Absolutely, absolutely. This is what I'm saying, yes, yes. That's what space is. That's what space is, right. It was a purely passive model, yes. Yes, yes, I know. Yeah, sure. Well, it might change the picture, but not completely. So... You know, this picture holds true as long as qualitatively, these pictures hold true as long as the depolarization in the dendrite generates spikes that are generated at the axon initial segment. And as long as this is the case, independently if your axon potential then backpropagate, right? As long as this is the independently if you generate a calcium spike in the dendrite, as long as your dendritic depolarization generates trains of spike that are all generated down at the axon initial segment, then this picture holds true. When on the other hand, just to go, you start to have dendritic depolarization that are so strong in which the spikes are actually generated all in the dendrites, then the situation might be different. No, we didn't. We didn't. Yeah. It's many tenths. It can be 30 baskets. And the way it has been estimated is by looking at the average number of contacts that one basket cell does on the soma. It's between T and 8. And look at the total number that is on the soma, which is several hundreds and so on. Okay. So essentially what I'm trying to say here, right, is that if excitation and inhibition are matched, right, you have a competitive effect. If they are non-matched, you have a non-competitive effect. Non-matched spatially, sorry. I mean spatially. So if they are matched in space, right, matched in the, yeah, the share the same space, right, then you have a competitive effect. If they are separated, then you don't. And so many of you know that that input onto various pyramidal cells in different parts of the cortex can have anatomically different origins and might be specifically distributed along the somatodendritic axis. And few good examples are in the hippocampus, in the CA3 region of the hippocampus. Pyramidal cells get a very, very proximal excitatory input, essentially on the really, really proximal portion of the apical dendrite, from axon called mossy fibers, which are the excitatory axon originating from granule cells in the hippocampus. Just a second. For example, in the olfactory bulb, in the olfactory cortex, pyramidal cells receive their main sensory input originating from the olfactory bulb on the very apical tuft, right, on the distal portion of the proximal of the apical dendrite. Yes. Yeah, that's the separation, right? Yeah, absolutely. You're right. Very good point. If they're separated in the other direction, then essentially you want, for the non-competitive effect, you want them to be separated and have inhibition closer to the action potential initiation zone, right? For it to be competitive, you want them to be spatially matched or inhibition be further away. That's very good. Very good. So okay, what I want to say is that along the somatodendritic axis of a pyramidal cell, you can have a different set of axon, of excitatory axon of different origin, some being more proximal and some being more distal. And so if what I told you about the position of excitation relative to inhibition is true, then you could imagine that somatic inhibition, right, is going to have a very different effect on the input-output curve generated by a proximal excitation as compared to input-output curve generated by a distal excitation, right? And so to test for this possibility, we did a very simple experiment. We took a mouse line in which the 5 pyramidal neuron expressed channel rhodopsin. This is expressed under the Taiwan promoter. By the way, all the other experiments I showed you were in rats and were in the hippocampus. And this is an experiment I'm going to show you. It's in the cortex, in the somatosensory cortex, and it comes from a mouse and not from a rat. But you will see the basic principle are the same. So this pyramidal cell expresses channel rhodopsin on its membrane, and we want to know whether somatic inhibition, the one generated by basket cell, right, is going to affect differentially distal excitation as compared to proximal excitation. And when I say affect, is affecting the input-output relationship. So the expectation based on what I told you before is that because proximal excitation and somatic inhibition are essentially spatially matched, somatic inhibition should produce a rightward shift of the input-output relationship with respect to excitation generated by proximal excitation, well, by proximal input, sorry. Well, you should produce a rightward shift and a capping of the maximal firing rate if the input-output relationship is generated by distal excitation. So to test for this, what we did is we patched the soma of such a pyramidal neuron and recorded in the voltage clamp mode the excitation generated by increasing amount of blue light, a blue light spot placed on the distal portion of the apical dendrite to mimic dendritic excitation. And you see that with increasing intensity, right, of this blue spot of light, you increase the excitatory current that you can generate at the soma. It becomes larger and larger. And in fact, if instead of recording from the pyramidal neuron in the voltage clamp mode, you record in the current clamp mode, you see that with a little bit of light, you make yourself spike. With more light, it spikes more. And with even more light, it spikes even more. And you can generate an input-output relationship here, on which you have the firing rate on the x-axis, and the excitation estimated in voltage clamp at the soma, as I showed you a second ago, on the x-axis, and you can have one of those input-output relationships. Yeah.
The relation is just longer.
Yeah, for like 1 second or so. Yeah. No. This is here we are in the presence of synaptic blocker. So what you are doing is directly depolarizing the membrane of the pyramidal cell. Thank you for asking that, by the way. I should have mentioned it. Directly, so the current that you're generating are direct photocurrents, are not synaptic currents. Okay. However, they are a good proxy for excitatory currents, at least in terms of reversal potential. Right. It's channel rhodopsin mediated current reverses at around zero. So it's No. We could have done that. That's a good point. No, what we did, this is the apparent conductance, and the apparent conductance is by measuring the somatic current that this illumination generates.
Probably be better to measure in terms of exact current than decoupled by the
series resistance. Yeah, well, in fact, it is the exact current just divided by our reversal potential, right? It's essentially this one is directly related to the current that I showed you, right? Obviously it's decoupled because it's up in the dendrite, but it doesn't matter much anyhow. We could have put the integral, the charge, and that would have been maybe even better because it's less filtered. Anyhow, so the point is that we have some x-axis that reflects some form of excitation and a firing rate on the y-axis, and an input-output relationship, which is what we care about. And we can generate the same, right, by illuminating a proximal portion of the apical dendrite. And now we can generate somatic inhibition. And how do we generate somatic inhibition? Again, using our dynamic clamp mode, right? And this is exactly the same as I showed you before, but instead of having a reversal potential at 0 millivolt, now you have a reversal potential at minus 75 millivolt or so, okay? And this is our mimicking of a basket cell of somatic inhibition. And what we observe is that if we put a somatic inhibition and while we are illuminating the apical tuft, we have not only a shift to the right, but also a capping of the maximal firing rate, and much less so for proximal excitation. And this is again, yes?
Is there just the two curves saturated?
Yeah, well, that's normal, right?
But is that a statement that the channel rhodopsin is saturated, or that you're just shunting current? It's not like you can just shine more and more light and get more and more current.
No, here not. I mean, you see that it saturates. You can imagine two possibilities, right? Either that you are saturating channel rhodopsin here, and so given. In this case, this is not saturation of channel rhodopsin, because otherwise I wouldn't see an increase in current, right? And the fact that there is an increase in conductance here means that I'm not saturating channel rhodopsin. Otherwise, I wouldn't see an increase in conductance. Remember that this scale is measured in voltage clamp at the soma, right? And so if by increasing more light I have a larger current, right, this means that channel rhodopsin hasn't saturated yet.
Measuring the conductance of the soma. in both cases, the natural conduction state and higher up the dendrite. That was a previous question.
Yeah.
So why for the same conductance in the stoma are you saturating at different levels of security?
Okay, well, for the same current in the stoma.
Yeah.
And why doesn't the same current in the stoma go the same current here?
So you're asking me why, if I measure the same current at the soma, I get different firing rates?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a good question. So what I think is going on here, right, is that if I the excitation scale here has been measured in voltage clamp, right, by voltage clamping the soma. The actual experiment in terms of firing rate is when I'm in current clamp. So you could imagine that when you illuminate the distal portion of the apical dendrite, you eventually have the nonlinearity due to the fact that you're approaching reversal potential, right, here. And so that despite that increase in conductance, the actual depolarization that you have at the dendrite is going to is saturating. I'm sorry? No, it wouldn't mean that my current at the soma is saturating, because if my voltage clamp was even just semi-decent, I could keep on having an increase in current at the soma because I'm voltage clamping. To some extent, I'm voltage clamping the dendrite. I mean, if my voltage clamp was perfect, I could have an immense amount of current generated in the apical dendrite, right, and yet saturate my membrane potential at a fraction of those current because I reach the reversal potential of excitation, and hence saturate my maximal firing rate. Okay. So the fact that I have an increase in current measured at the soma when I'm voltage clamping the soma, while I increase the illumination of my apical tuft, right, doesn't mean that I cannot reach the maximal depolarization of the apical tuft with a fraction of the current that I'm measuring at the soma. You don't seem convinced. I mean, I can try to. Anyhow, all right. So then maybe to wrap just this question up, what I think is going on is that with this apical illumination, I'm reaching essentially maximal depolarization of the dendrite, despite the fact that I can still keep on increasing the amount of current that enters, but I'm very close to the reversal potential, right? And so this is the maximal firing rate that I can get by illuminating the dendrite. With the soma, I can get a higher firing rate because I'm closer to the soma, and so I can, all right? And essentially, if we focus here on the summary graph for this experiment, is that if excitation is generated by depolarizing the proximal portion of the apical dendrite, right, somatic inhibition, right, is going to shift the excitatory conductance necessary to get to the half maximal firing rate, but I'm going to still be able to reach my maximal firing rate. And so again, if excitation and inhibition are spatially matched, right, I have a competitive effect. On the other hand, I have a massive decrease in the firing rate, in the maximal firing rate with somatic inhibition when excitation is generated on the apical tuft of the dendrites. And so, essentially, proximal excitatory input for proximal excitatory input, somatic inhibition shifts the input output to the right. And for distal excitatory input, somatic inhibition also reduces the maximal firing rate. So actually, the best model I've seen is a crayfish model by Vu and Krasne in 1992, in which there is a neuron in this crayfish that receives inhibitory inputs on the soma or on the dendrite, and there is a behavior which is linked, an escape or a feeding behavior, which is linked to the activation of those different inputs, and there is essentially a competitive or non-competitive effect, and those Wu and Krasny modeled this relatively well. Yes, so it's at least what happens here in pyramidal neurons in cortical structure seem to be consistent with what has been observed in the crayfish and modeled in the crayfish. Yeah? All right. So we can go on and speak about network stuff if you want. How much time do I have?
To 11.
All right, so I'm going to run through this part then.
Wow.
Anyhow, we go up to where we go. What should I do?
David was asking in part is what you know, compared to sort of raw model, right, going on, it seems to be very much in the flavor of raw models. So like what Ken mentioned, you know, in addition, you can...
Yeah. Yeah. Look, as I said, I mean, I might have to do a better search of the literature, but the model that more closely describes this phenomenon that I've seen in the literature is this paper that appeared in 1992 and really only assumes passive cable characteristics and inhibitory and excitatory input with a reversal potential separated by about 70 millivolt. And this is all you need if you have an action initial a spike initial zone which is separated from the dendrites essentially. Okay. All right. So networks. So pyramidal cells in the cortex generate a lot of that have very very big axons, and a large fraction of their targets are local, as symbolized here by this outtaps. I'm not implying that there are outtapses. Actually, outtapses are quite rare in excitatory neuron in the cortex, but this is just to symbolize that recurrent activity is a large portion of the axons of pyramidal neuron in cortical area. And there are very few exceptions. C1 pyramidal cells are actually an exception, but otherwise, in most of the layers of the cortex and the C3 region of the hippocampus, recurrent excitation is prominent. However, despite being prominent, it's not the only form of excitation. Pyramidal cells have also longer range projections in the cortex. Those long-range projections can be across layer, for example, layer 2-3 to layer 5, or across domains, right? For example, layer 2-3 pyramidal cell can excite a distinct domain and even actually cross the callosum and excite the other hemisphere. And so through those projections, pyramidal cell generates domains of excitation, right? Both locally and distally. Now, as we know, pyramidal cells also form about 10 to 20% of their excitatory synapses onto so-called local GABAergic interneurons. And those local GABAergic interneurons, for example, basket cells, for example, bistratified neuron, I'm not sure a Martinotti cell can be considered a local inhibitory interneuron, but maybe. And by exciting GABAergic interneuron, right, they're desynaptically also generate zones of inhibition. And so the question that I'm going to address in the second part of the talk is what is the spatial relationship between those domains of excitation and domains of inhibition generated by activity of pyramidal neuron? And in particular, what the net effect on the neuron output is of those domains. So as a model, we decided to take layer 2-3 pyramidal neurons of the somatosensory cortex. And those layer 2-3 pyramidal cells have radial projections to excite layer 5 neuron in addition to collateral projection, as well as a tangential projection to excite neighboring barrel columns. Remember, this is a schematic illustration of the cortex. Thalamic input reach the cortex mainly by arborizing in layer 4, where they excite excitatory neuron in layer 4 that then impinge on layer 2-3 neuron, and then layer 2-3 neuron excite layer 5 neuron radially, and then other layer 2-3 neuron tangentially, right? So this is a schematic of a portion of the canonical circuit in the cortex. So what we need here in order to study the domains of excitation inhibition generated by layer 2-3 pyramidal cell is to be able to selectively activate layer 2-3 pyramidal neuron. And only activating selectively layer 2-3 pyramidal neuron cannot be done using sensory stimulation, because as I just mentioned, sensory stimulation would activate the thalamus, would then activate layer 4 neurons, those layer 4 neuron would activate then layer 2-3 neurons, and so you'd have a whole number, various populations of excitatory neuron activated in the cortex. And neither you can activate a population of layer 2-3 pyramidal cell just by sticking a stimulation electrode in layer 2-3, right? Because there you would activate layer 2-3 pyramidal cell, you would activate antidromically layer 4 pyramidal cell, actually antidromically also layer 5 pyramidal cell. And so we decided to use channel rhodopsin again and express channel rhodopsin selectively in layer 2-3 pyramidal cell. And you can do this relatively simply by using in utero electroporation, in which you expose the embryos of a pregnant rat at embryonic stage 15, so 6 days before their birth, and you inject into the ventricle of the developing cortex a plasmid containing the gene for channel rhodopsin fused to some fluorescent protein marker. Sorry? You can do it both on rats and mice. Did I say rats, though? This was done in mouse. Anyhow, you can do it in rats and mouse. I guess you can do it to any organism. We did this in mice. Sorry. And then you apply once you fill the ventricle with 1 microliter or so of your construct, you can zap a current through the brain, electroporate neuronal precursor cells that are actually lining the walls of this ventricle, push your construct into those cells, and then those cells are going to become neuron. And since the cortex is developed in an inside-out fashion, right? At E15, you're going to target those neuron precursor cells that are going to give rise to the last layer 2-3, right? And that works very well when you zap those little embryos, then you put them back in the belly of the mom, you stitch everything back. 6 days later, the mom gives birth to those pups, and when they are weaned, you can, between P15 and P30, you can cut slices from those animals, those mice. And you can see that indeed, you selectively express channel rhodopsin in layer 2-3, right? This is a section through the barrel cortex. What you can see is actually the cell bodies of those layer 2-3 pyramidal cells. And you can see a second band here, which corresponds to the axonal arborization of those layer 2-3 pyramidal cell into layer 5, right? And you can identify as a negative, essentially, layer 4. And so 20 to 30% of those pyramidal cells actually express channel rhodopsin. And what's very cool about this approach is that inhibitory neurons, which are generated somewhere else in the brain, are actually not transfected. And so you are only only expressing channel rhodopsin in excitatory neurons. And the channel rhodopsin expressed at a high enough level to generate spiking if you illuminate those pyramidal cells, as seen here through this cell attached configuration. So because the ganglionic eminence, right, is a little bit lower and down. And so in order to reach the ganglionic eminence where inhibitory neurons are generated, right? Inhibitory neurons are, you would have to put, it's quite complicated, and you would have to put the electrodes that you use to create this potential across the head in a weird position. So people have managed to electroporate a neuronal precursor cell of the ganglionic eminence, but it's done with very specific approaches with regard to the positioning of the electrodes around the plate and to the injection of the plasmid, actually.
Did you just happen to check to see if you didn't get those? Because, you know, they're pretty close.
All right, so... All right, so there is a very simple control experiment, though, that you can do to know whether indeed you are channel rhodopsin is present in inhibitory neuron or not, which is to take a slice, to put antagonist for excitatory transmission so that only inhibitory transmission is there, record from a pyramidal cell, flash blue light, and see whether you have inhibitory currents. Yes or no? Yes. Well, you don't hit them because they're probably not. So there are two answers to this question. One is whether we actually target inhibitory neuron, and the answer is absolutely no, right? Because you do the experiment, as I said before, you look whether there are inhibitory neurons that are excited by channel rhodopsin, and they are known because none of them expresses channel rhodopsin. Now, what you want, you're surprised by the fact somehow that this method selectively targets excitatory neurons in the cortex, right? And you're saying because the ganglionic eminence is closed, because some of them are already... So it's possible that the ones that are already invading the cortex tangentially are not close enough to the inner wall of the ventricle to be transfected. It's very lucky, man. I didn't appreciate how lucky I was. Now I know, and I'm such a happier man. All right, so but it's a fact. I mean, it's actually, and it has been reported by several labs that this form of inhibitory electroporation at A14 to 15 doesn't affect inhibitory neurons in the cortex. Anyhow, so what we did is with one of those animals, right, we wanted to see what happens if we just shine blue light and activate those layer 2-3 pyramidal cells, and so we did a small craniotomy. In one of those anesthetized little animals, we placed a field recording, an extracellular recording electrode in layer 2-3, and gave a ramp of blue light lasting about 2 seconds, right? And what we observed to our surprise is that instead of generating a flurry of uncoordinated activity, right, we generated an oscillation. And this oscillation is seen here by the onset of the ramp of blue light. You see this very strong oscillation of the LFP, which stops as soon as the blue light is stopped. And in this box, this trace is a temporal magnification of what's shown in this box, right? You see this oscillation. And if you filter out this oscillation to selectively look at units, right, you see that there is a spiking multi-unit activity in phase with those oscillations. And those oscillations in this particular experiment have a frequency of about 50 or 52 hertz, right? And there is absolutely, this frequency is essentially not present under control condition. We can do whole cell recordings and whole cell voltage clamp recordings and look at either the excitatory or the inhibitory component generated during those oscillations in vivo, right, by voltage clamping the cell at the reversal potential for excitation or for inhibition. And what you can see is that both the excitatory as well as the inhibitory component oscillate at this frequency in response to a ramp of light. Yes?
So the same thing, Marco, the light turns on and then it starts to oscillate and it's getting brighter and stays at the same frequency?
I'm going to get into that in a moment. Okay.
Is this
anesthetized? Yeah. Yeah, it's isofluorine. It were low level with isofluorine. That's a good point. If you increase the level of isofluorine to 5 or 6%, it stops, right? So you need to be at 1.5%. Sorry?
Yeah,
we put them down at 5%, right? So that's why. But so it needs to be like 1.5%, and the lower the better, essentially. But it's anesthetized. And luckily enough for us and for the rest of the experiment we've done, we can generate this oscillation very well also in acute slices. This is an experiment, an acute coronal slice from the barrel cortex, and we're recording from pyramidal cells, from two pyramidal cells simultaneously. One is voltage clamp at the reversal potential for excitation, the other at the reversal potential for inhibition. And you see not only that these ramp of light generate oscillation in both, but those are oscillations are in phase. And this is the peak frequency of the oscillation in vivo and in vitro. In vivo, it's about 42, 43 hertz. In vitro, it's about 35 hertz. And so it's the fact that you have the co-occurrence of excitation and inhibition, and the fact that it's between 35 and 50 hertz is consistent with gamma oscillations observed in those.
Why what happens if you have a constant?
Yeah. So if you give a square pulse instead of a ramp, the first 200 or 300 milliseconds generate a very strong and uncoordinated activity, and eventually it relaxes to an oscillation, right? And the reason is that if you do a voltage clamp pulse cell recording from a pyramidal cell expressing channel rhodopsin in response to a square pulse of light, you have first a very, very large current due to a very large channel rhodopsin generated photocurrent, which then desensitizes and stabilizes to a steady state. So the reason why we gave a ramp was to avoid this very strong transient. And indeed, with this ramp, we have a more round onset, which then stabilizes. Okay? No, I'll show it in a moment. So by the way, all experiments I'm showing here are recordings from pyramidal cells that do not express channel rhodopsin. Okay, only 20 to 30% express channel rhodopsin, and I don't want those recording. We don't want those recording to be contaminated by the photocurrent. So we're recording from the 80 to 70% of pyramidal cells that actually do not express channel rhodopsin, although they are intermingled with pyramidal cell expressing it. Well, it actually does. Eventually, it saturates, and I don't know whether. Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure why. I wonder whether at a given point the slope of your light reaches a situation in which the amount of channel rhodopsin that is desensitizing and the new one that you are recruiting is somehow described by this slope, right? But it's essentially what. We tuned it for doing that. Even better would be to have a situation in which instead of a linear ramp, it was slightly curved. It would reach the steady state earlier and then.
These postsynaptic currents that you show, are they synchronized from one cell to another?
Yes. It's shown actually here. Those are two recorded neurons simultaneously. One in which you look at the excitation, and the other one in which you look at the inhibition, and they are perfectly in phase. Actually, there is a latency of maybe 1 millisecond. Inhibition follows excitation by 1 or 2 milliseconds, but essentially they are within a cycle. They are perfectly in phase. Okay. And so blocking AMPA receptor activation, okay, with NBQX. Completely abolishes those oscillations, blocking inhibition, right, with gabazine, completely blocking those oscillations. In fact, we're using here substituting doses of the GABA A receptor inhibitor gabazine, because otherwise the whole thing becomes epileptic. But even substituting concentrations are sufficient to completely block the oscillation, right? Yeah, maybe there is not. Maybe at those light level there is not enough metabotropic receptor activation. What do I know?
Yeah.
Anyhow, it's very clearly blocked by AMPA receptor antagonists.
No, the data.
I don't know. So yeah, whatever. So the oscillation relies on both glutamatergic and GABAergic transmission. This is a fact, right? You block it either by blocking GABAergic or blocking glutamatergic transmission. And now, with respect to the slope of this ramp, right, and the frequency, so this is an in vivo recording, and what it shows is that yes, by increasing the intensity of light, you increase the frequency of the oscillation, but actually not that much. This was our most prominent effect, right? You see, you go from a frequency of 40 hertz to maybe 50, 55 hertz, but overall, right, from the onset of light that is just sufficient to generate an oscillation to the one that saturates, right, there is maybe 20-30% increase, not much, okay? And this is true also in vitro. So the intensity of light or the slope of this ramp increases the frequency, but not by that much. Maybe you can increase it by maybe 20-30%. On the other hand, what you can increase massively is the amplitude of the oscillation with the slope of the ramp. So the frequency is quite set there between 30 and 60 hertz, I would say. And the way we see it is that essentially you have a channel rhodopsin expressing pyramidal neuron, you excite them, those guys excite other pyramidal cell, but they also excite inhibitory neuron, which then inhibit those pyramidal cell, and then you generate this gamma activity. And this is the standard model by which we believe gamma activity occurs in the cortex. Yes. Okay, so based on the experiments that I'm showing you here, I don't think that I could exclude it, right? But we've done experiments that could exclude it. Now, if you, for example, express channel rhodopsin selectively in a fast-spiking neuron, right? Then if you give a ramp of light or a square pulse of light, you do not generate 40 to 60 hertz oscillation. You have to pulse it to generate at 60 hertz to generate 60 hertz oscillation. But such a pulse of light doesn't generate those oscillations. In fact, if you generate oscillation, those are much higher frequencies. That's no? Okay, so
because the inputs are different, right? You can only go to your channel adoption and coming in, and the input can come everywhere.
All right, so you're saying maybe I need a tonic input to inhibitory neuron, and that by they generate the 60 hertz oscillation, but this tonic input cannot be mimicked by a pulse of blue light, by a ramp of blue light. This, right? Maybe this, and then yes, then I cannot exclude it. But so this is my view of it, but maybe this what is it? Ping view of it, maybe she knows better. Is not it.
Just in the original Jeffries experiment, you know, they would do things like a diazepam or picture with all sorts of things to change the high scale inhibition. Mm. They'd watch gamma frequency shift. But then you can kind of do that here because you could also, I don't know if there are molecules that change the high constant of excited for transmission.
Yeah, they are, obviously.
That would be maybe a way to do it.
Yeah. I mean,
that was part of their argument.
Yeah, it's so. What is clear is that sometimes you put NBQX and there is still some oscillation remaining at the right frequency, although the amplitude is much less, and then you put an NMDA receptor and it's gone.
But if you say take out and use it to drive it slow.
Yeah, we haven't done that. Yeah. Mm. I don't know. Okay, yeah, good point. So yeah, so maybe the channel rhodopsin experiment in parvalbumin cell is not the right way to address your I don't know. So this is the way we see it. Maybe we see it the wrong way, but it doesn't matter because the experiment that I'm going to present afterwards are independent of this model. The fact is that now we have a way to activate layer 2-3 pyramidal cell in with a dynamic that is self-generated, right? And in the next 5 minutes, I'm going to squeeze a 45 minutes of a talk. But so let's start asking this spatial relationship between excitation and inhibition. So this is how a layer 2-3 pyramidal neuron excites its target, both through local arborization into layer 2-3 as to more distal radial projection into layer 5. Now, how about inhibition, right? So unfortunately, inhibitory neuron, like I showed you at the beginning, are very heterogeneous and expands their axonal arborization in the cortex, both across columns, right, across domains, as well as across layers. So based on anatomy, it is very difficult to predict the distribution, the spatial distribution of excitation in the cortex upon activation of layer 2-3 pyramidal cell. So in theory, you could imagine that inhibition is going to be global, right? When layer 2-3 pyramidal cell are active, every layer is going to be inhibited. You could imagine that inhibition is going to be complementary, right? Such that inhibition is stronger in those layers that don't receive direct excitation from layer 2-3 pyramidal cell. Or you could imagine that inhibition is going to be absolutely matched. And so we tested this possibility by recording simultaneously from layer 2-3, layer 4, layer 5, and layer 6 excitatory neuron, and generated with a light ramp oscillation by activating layer 2-3. And what you can see, consistent with the axonal arborization of layer 2-3 pyramidal cell, our ramp generates oscillation in layer 2-3, then nothing in layer 4 because layer 2-3 axon don't arborize in layer 4, and then again, strong oscillatory activity in layer 5 because the axon of layer 5 pyramidal cell, or layer 2-3 pyramidal cell, arborize in layer 5, and nothing in layer 6, right? So how about with the recruited inhibition? And this is inhibition recorded by voltage clamping to same neuron at the reversal potential for excitation. And as you can see, inhibition is perfectly matched with excitation. And this is a summary graph for a number of similar experiments in which both excitation and inhibition are normalized here in layer 2-3. And you see that it's minimal in layer 4. It's again strongly present in layer 5 and minimal in layer 6. And this is for the power of the oscillation, reflecting the presence of excitation and inhibition in those layers. And so essentially, inhibition is clearly not global, is not complementary, but is spatially perfectly matched, right, with excitation. So inhibition generated by activity of layer 2-3 is precisely matched across layer. So how about a tangential projection, right? So the layer 2-3 pyramidal cell creates axonal, horizontal axon, both in layer 2-3 and layer 4, can span several hundreds of micrometers. And so again, you could imagine that you have a surround inhibition, right? Inhibition is stronger at the edges as compared to the core. You could imagine that you have surround excitation, so that excitation is stronger at the edges as compared to the core. Or you could imagine that inhibition and excitation are spatially matched. And so to address this question, we illuminated with a spot of blue light, right, a single barrel column in layer 2-3. And this is a spot of blue light that has a diameter about 90 micrometer, and this is sufficient to generate locally excitation, as shown from this recorded pyramidal cell, right? So you don't need to have a full field illumination; you can just illuminate a little spot of light right there, and then you can translate this light across this light spot across barrel columns like this, right? And you can see that. This layer 2-3 pyramidal cell receives oscillatory activity if you eliminate the two neighboring barrels, right? But eventually, this excitatory activity decays. And if you voltage clamp the pyramidal cell at the reversal potential for inhibition, for excitation in order to isolate inhibition, you see that the behavior of inhibition is at least qualitatively very similar. It's maximal at the center and decays. And you can quantify that for a number of experiments. This is the excitatory charge. It's maximal within the barrel column that is illuminated and then decays when translating that illumination spot across barrel column. And you have essentially the mirror image for inhibition. And you can take this curve, right? Those are normalized curves, and flip it over. And you see that it perfectly matches the decay of excitation, right? So
scales are usually different, or
Yeah. We'll speak about this later. But at least in terms of inhibition is much larger than excitation. But in terms of how it decays, right? It perfectly matches excitation, which essentially means that the ratio between excitation and inhibition remains constant across barrels, right? Inhibition is much stronger, as David correctly noticed, and we're going to discuss this in a moment, but the ratio remains the same. And this is true also for layer 5 pyramidal cells that receive input. This is true also in layer 5, right? Excitation and inhibition are perfectly matched. So there is no surround inhibition with more excitation on the core. There is no surround excitation. There is a very well matched excitation and inhibition with respect to ratio. Yes? Okay, so I see a traveling wave, but this traveling wave has essentially the speed, maybe I have a slide for it, the speed of the propagation along the axon of layer 2-3 pyramidal cells. Yes. And here it is actually. Very good. So if you record from 4 pyramidal cells, right, and you generate the oscillation in one of them, here you see the phase of the oscillation, and the speed is about 250 millimeter per second, which is really the propagation of action potential along the axon of layer 2-3. So it's a very slow propagation, but those are very thin axons. Okay, very good point. So excitation and inhibition remain proportional across columns, both in layer 2-3 and layer 5. And so in the last 2 minutes, can I have another couple of minutes or not? Yeah. So what is the functional consequence, right? Well, so now excitation and inhibition are perfectly matched in space, both across layer and across columns. What is the functional consequence? And the way that we address this is the following. We record that simultaneously from layer 2-3 and layer 5 pyramidal cells. And depolarized those two cells, we recorded from them in current clamp mode, and depolarized them by injecting a square step of current in order to make them spike at about 10 hertz or so. Okay? So this is without any light. And then the question is, if we now generate an oscillation by illuminating layer 2-3, what's going to happen to this imposed 10 hertz firing frequency, right? And so here's what happened in layer 2-3. You give, you not only inject the current, but also you give this ramp of lights to generate the oscillation. And the firing of layer 2-3 pyramidal cell is completely suppressed. And in fact, if you look at the membrane potential trajectory, right, of this layer 2-3 cell, you can identify this rapid gamma oscillation, right? But essentially, it has a suppressive effect on layer 2-3 pyramidal cell. What happens on layer 5 pyramidal neuron? On layer 5 pyramidal neuron, it's the opposite. You increase the firing frequency, okay? So this is summarized here for a number of experiments. This is the normalized change in spike rate, right? You see that layer 2-3 pyramidal cell, many of them are completely suppressed. Some of them are reduced, but overall, on layer 2-3 pyramidal cell, gamma activity generated by illuminating layer 2-3 produces a strong suppression and produces overall a facilitation in layer 5 pyramidal cell. And this is the effect within the same barrel column. What happens if you translate your light spot across barrel? Well, the maximal suppression of layer 2-3 pyramidal cell occurs when the oscillatory activity is generated actually within the home barrel, and this suppressive activity is progressively reduced as you translate the light across barrels. And the maximal facilitatory effect of layer 5 pyramidal cell is again occur within barrel and then decays when you translate your light across barrels. And this facilitatory effect of layer 5 pyramidal neurons upon oscillation in layer 2-3 and suppressive effect in layer 2-3 occurs also in vivo. You can do a whole cell recording from a layer 2-3 pyramidal cell in vivo, inject current, in order for the pyramidal cell to spike at about 10 hertz or so, and then give your pulse of light, and you see that you generate this gamma activity as shown here by this membrane potential, but the spiking activity is suppressed. And this is a summary graph for six or seven similar experiments. And well, if you do look at unit activity in layer 5, right, by you see that the light produces this strong oscillation, and unit activity strongly increases. This is not a single unit, it's many units at the same time. Which current? Yes, sure, but this is shown here, right? It doesn't go, this is an example in which it goes to zero, so it's probably this one. This is an example in which it starts at 20 hertz and goes at 5 hertz. Yeah, sure. This is light injection, this is the current injection in layer 2-3. The current injection into a layer 2-3 pyramidal cell to make it spike, because the spontaneous spiking activity layer 2-3 is very low, right? So we made it spike at a frequency that in this series of experiments varies between 5 and 20 hertz. And generating gamma activity by light illumination produces a suppression of this firing rate. We didn't do that, actually. You're saying to actually match it with up states in which there is more spontaneous activity. We haven't done that. Yeah, good point. No. Those are different sets of experiments. This is a whole cell recording with a glass pipette. This is unit activity with a metal pipette. We show we show light, we illuminate the craniotomy essentially. Sorry? Here's just the light, and what you see is there is a relatively little unit activity before the light in layer 5, although layer 5 is much more active in anesthetized animal than layer 2-3. So you know that you are in layer 5 because suddenly you start to see a lot of spontaneous activity, and there is some of it here. There is much less in layer 2-3. But when you illuminate the light, you strongly increase the spontaneous activity. So for this series of unit recording, right, you have this 5 hertz activity before light, and then with light it goes all the way to 25. But again, this is not those are not isolated units. This is multi-unit.
This layer 2-3 cell has traveled without.
No. And in fact, the reason why we did whole cell recording for layer 2-3 is not only because we need to inject current to make them spike, but also because we need to make sure that the cell we record from are not cells that express channel rhodopsin, which certainly would increase their spiking when you give light, because you directly and actively depolarize them. Okay, so excitation and inhibition are matched in space and across layer. However, within layer 2-3, you have this very strong lateral suppression when you activate layer 2-3 pyramidal cell, and you have a strong feed-forward facilitation of layer 5. And to wrap it up, because we're already very late, the question is, what is the mechanism? How come that you essentially facilitate layer 5 neuron and you suppress layer 2-3 neuron? And the reason for this is that the excitation inhibition ratio is different between layer 5 and layer 2-3 neuron. There is a much larger excitation inhibition ratio in layer 5 as compared to layer 2-3. And so this is just correlative evidence to make sure that the difference in excitation inhibition ratio between layer 2-3 and layer 5 cell can actually account for the suppressive effect in layer 2-3 and the facilitating effect in layer 5. We actually dynamically clamped in either layer 2-3 or layer 5 cell with two pipettes the excitation and the excitatory and the inhibitory waveform that we recorded either from layer 2-3 or from layer 5. And so those are a layer 2-3 cell and a layer 5 cell. We inject just a square pulse of current to make them fire. And then we inject in either the layer 2-3 or the layer 5 cell the excitatory and inhibitory waveform recorded in layer 2-3. And if you inject it in a layer 2-3 cell, you suppress that layer 2-3 cell. But you also suppress it if you inject it in a layer 5 cell. Well, if you inject a layer 5 waveform in a layer 2, 3 cell, you increase its firing. And if you inject a layer 5 waveform in a layer 5 cell, you increase their firing. So this shows that actually the specific waveform that they get, and in particular the excitation inhibition ratio, the different excitation inhibition ratio that layer 2, 3 and layer 5 cell get, it contributes to this suppression or facilitation of those two neurons. So, In conclusion, at the single neuron level, a special relationship between excitation inhibition along the somatodendritic axis enable a differential control of the neuronal output. Dendritic inhibition generate this rightward shift in the input-output curve, and somatic inhibition this capping of the maximal firing rate. And at the network level, excitation and inhibition are matched in space, right? Both radially across layer and tangentially across column. And the local difference in excitation inhibition ratio generate lateral suppression in layer 2, 3 and feed-forward facilitation in layer 5. And so we believe that this mechanism allows, right, for the activity of a cluster of layer 2, 3 pyramidal cell to compete for cortical space, because it's going to suppress its neighbor and essentially hijack layer 5 pyramidal cell that are not only restricted within its own column, but also lateral to it. Anyhow, this is the most important slide. Those are the people who did this work. Hillel Adesnik, a postdoc in my lab, Frederick Puy, who used to be in my lab up to 2 years ago, Bassam Atala, a graduate student in my lab, and some of this work has been done in collaboration with Andrew Trevelyan in the UK. So there are more questions. Mike? Yeah, we don't know, actually. We are still looking at it. And so the first step for it is to understand which GABAergic neurons are involved in during those oscillations. And that's even yet not quite clear, right? It's not just basket cell, we thought at the beginning. Martinotti cell actually play a very important role too. And so if it's Martinotti cell, the question becomes, well, maybe it's just that dendritic inhibition on layer 5 pyramidal cell is more distal as compared to layer 2, 3, and so it could be a matter of space there too. Could be, I mean, there are plenty of possible explanations, and we don't know. So what we know is that we can drive both interneuron in layer 2, 3 as well as in layer 5 during the oscillation, but we haven't quantified it sufficiently to say whether it's different. Well, no, this has not been observed. What is well known is that there is very little excitatory input from layer 2, 3 back on layer 4. This is we didn't discover that, right? This is an anatomical fact that layer 2, 3 excite very little layer 4. And so the possibility that indeed things might happen in layer 2, 3 that layer 4 has no idea of Now I have to say that when we record, from the visual cortex, for example, in vivo, and we give a visual stimulus that generates gamma activity in the cortex, then we see this gamma activity across all layers. Okay, it's not identical, but we see it across all layers. So we. But this is obviously sensory activity that starts in layer 4 and then go on to layer 2, 3. So I don't know how much of what we see in layer 2, 3 is dictated by layer 4. I'm not aware of anything in the literature that shows properties of activity in layer 2, 3 that that are completely independent from layer 4, but it wouldn't surprise me because there is no feedback to layer 4. Yeah.
And in many parts of the brain where there is no layer 4, we have seen that increased gamma power in the parietal cortex.
I'm sorry?
We have seen that in the parietal cortex, where the amount of layer 4 is minimal. So I'm wondering whether that could contribute. Of course, that's not in vivo, there are lateral connections and so on. But perhaps that could support this.
Okay, so we can induce those oscillations in layer 2, 3 in three cortices. We've tested it in three cortices. One of them has very little layer 4. So we can do them in the barrel cortex, in the visual cortex, and in the cingulate cortex. And so, yes, I think there is no need for layer 4. I think you're right. We haven't tested that. No. What I just said with the visual cortex is the fact that we can induce oscillation, but we haven't done any experiment to see whether there is a match. Yes, I would expect it. In my opinion, it's yes, definitely, absolutely.
Okay, we're gonna thank Massimo for a great talk.
All right, thanks.